coming and being part of this event, the first Gimbal session. I'm going to record, and Isabel's going to record, just like we did before, so that's just a reminder. And also a reminder, if you ask a question, I'm going to repeat it for the recording. And if you don't want your question to be recorded, or if you want to remove, just say so when you ask it, or just email us afterwards, and we can have no problem. So I'm Holden Karnofsky. I'm co-founder of GiveWell and also the Open Philanthropy Project. But as of this year, GiveWell and Open Philanthropy are separate organizations. We still share an office. I'm still on the board of GiveWell, but otherwise I don't work for GiveWell. And so I focus on the Open Philanthropy Project, and I'm going to talk for a bit about just some of the basics, just to catch people up who don't know them, but focusing more on what's recent for the Open Philanthropy Project, and then I'll take questions just like in the first session. So the basics, for those of you who aren't familiar, which maybe some of you, Open Philanthropy started as part of GiveWell. So GiveWell initially was proven cost-effective, scalable giving opportunities. And we met Kerry Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz a few years ago. And they were looking for how to give away a very large fortune, into billions of dollars, within their lifetimes. And so this to us was a problem that in some ways is very similar to the one that GiveWell tries to solve, and in some ways very different. The similarity is looking for how to do as much good as possible with your charitable giving, and not really knowing where to start, and not having a lot of intellectual content out there to help you do the most good that you can. So that's the part that was familiar, and the part that is not so familiar is just kind of the nature of the giving that Kerry and Dustin were, the amount they were giving away, and the time frame over which they were giving it, and their ability to kind of, or their dedication to, basically spending their lives on this. So Kerry was about to go full-time when we met, and she's now full-time. And so a philanthropist like that, I think, has a slightly different situation from, let's say, someone who is one of the original GiveWell customers. So when we first started GiveWell, it was based on me and Ellie and what we needed when we were, trying to give away money with a few hours to think about where to give it, and at the end of the year, and wanting something where we could really follow and understand the entire case. And working with Kerry and Dustin, we saw maybe a little bit more of an opportunity to do giving that could be in some ways higher risk, in some ways longer time horizon, and could require or involve doing things like building out their own staff, forming their own networks, getting to the point where they trust certain people and have relationships with them that allow them to, to do things that may be, to do giving opportunities that may be harder to explain and communicate to the outside world, and also just be able to do things like create new organizations rather than just funding those that exist and to really transform existing organizations. So that's kind of where we're coming from in terms of the overall approach of Open Phil and how we got to the causes we work on now. One of the key philosophies of Open Phil is this idea of hits-based giving. So the idea is if you can take a lot, what you might do is you might look for giving opportunities where for every 10 times you give, you sort of fail completely and maybe even embarrassingly 9 times, and then one does so well that it makes up for everything else. So this is maybe a model that's familiar from venture capital, and we think that this model is an interesting one for philanthropy that somewhat contrasts with the GiveWell approach, where GiveWell tends to look for the things that are most evidence-backed. If you look at some of the biggest historical philanthropic successes, some of them were so big. Like, for example, the feminist philanthropy that really funded the research behind the pill, the common oral contraceptive, when the government wouldn't fund that, it wouldn't have funded that. Or the Rockefeller Foundation funding research on improved crops that is widely believed to have led to the Green Revolution, many large countries kind of going out of poverty and becoming medium developed countries, and leading to, probably over a billion people who didn't starve to death because of the Green Revolution. Could you imagine that wins like those are part of philanthropy's history? You could also imagine that you could have a lot of failures, and if you had one success like that, it would really be compensated for. So that's part of the general philosophy of Open Phil, and in some ways it's kind of contrast to GiveWell, because I think GiveWell looks for a lot of times the things that are most supported by evidence, things that can be understood, things that can be explained, things where you can trace the impact of your giving, and a lot of times Open Phil is trying to just swing so hard that the occasional win is good enough. This is a simplification, and there are definitely points of overlap, times when GiveWell is funding things that take risks, and kind of an Open Phil is trying to stick with what's more proven or linear, but that is something of a theme of where you'll see the two diverge and take different approaches. In terms of, you know, how OpenPhil has selected the areas that it works in, we spent the first few years really trying to build up a framework and choose areas to specialize in, choose what we call focus areas. Basically, the idea is we believe one of the most important decisions a philanthropist makes is just what problems to work on. And if you can choose the best problems to work on, then from there you can kind of build your organization around developing expertise in those problems. And so we looked for problems or focus areas that we felt were some good combination of being important, meaning if we got a win, it would affect a lot of persons and it would affect them a lot. Neglected, meaning we tend to look at who else is working in an area, and we don't want to work in an area that is kind of overrun with other philanthropists. And then finally, tractable, meaning we see some sort of path to impact. And if we can see causes that stand out on those criteria, those are the causes we want to enter. So we spent a couple of years just exploring all the causes we could work on, assessing them, and importance, neglectedness, tractability. And then we spent, you know, probably about a year really focused just on hiring. So we knew what areas we wanted to work on, but we wanted to make sure we found the best possible people to specialize in those areas and to lead our work in those areas. And then from there, the OpenPhil philosophy is really, you know, you try to have the best causes, the best people, and let those people lead the way from there. And so there's not a lot more rules after that point. Our program officers usually are experts in their fields. They're usually, you know, among the sort of most knowledgeable people about their fields, and they become even more knowledgeable on the job. And we really let them lead the way. And we have what we call a 50-40-10 principle, which is that we want, you know, someone who, let's say Chloe works on criminal justice reform, or Lewis who works on farm animal welfare, we ask that half of their portfolio by dollars be such that the decision makers, the people who approve the grants, which is me and Carrie, we can understand and explain and affirmatively agree with half of the issue, but only half. And so another 40% of that portfolio would be in what we sometimes call the okay category, which is like, I can see how one might think this is a good grant if one knew a lot more than I do. I don't personally totally buy it, but we're going to approve the grant anyway. And then the final 10% is generally discretionary. So a lot of times there's a very stripped down process, and program officers are able to get grants through pretty fast without really convincing us of anything, as long as we don't see any red flags. And you know, the goal there, the principle there, is that if you have the right cause, you pick the right cause, and you pick the right people, from there we see a lot of value in actually minimizing the number of decision makers, minimizing the number of veto points, and letting knowledge be distributed, letting the leadership come from the person who knows the area the best. And we figure as long as half of our portfolio is something that we're really on board with, we can let the other half be stuff that we didn't have the time or expertise to fully understand the case for, but we've got a person who believes in it. And I do believe that a lot of the best giving in this kind of high-risk genre is going to come from doing things that are hard to explain and that take a lot of context, and where you may need to really understand a lot of personalities and a lot of complexity. And so the more you can minimize that number of decision makers and veto points, the better. So that's the basic philosophy of OpenPhil. Happy to answer more questions about, you know, sort of what causes we work on and why. But for now, I'm just going to list some of the things we've been doing, because it's now been a couple of years that we've been giving in the $100 to $200 million a year range. We do expect that number to go up more over time, but for now we're sort of trying to learn a lot of lessons and get the best possible process in place and have a great understanding of what we're doing before we expand more. So some of the causes we work in and some of the things we've done, farm animal welfare is an example of a cause that we selected and hired for based on one of the main themes of our giving, which I refer to as radical empathy, which is this idea that if there are certain parts of the population that today are not even considered to be people and are not considered to have rights at all and are highly marginalized, it's often the case, we feel, that our giving can do the most good by focusing on those parts of the population. And so if you look historically and you ask what are some of the best things you could have done, you know, being early to various civil rights, feminist causes, I think before there was much agreement at all that those causes even were worthy of consideration at all, I think you would have done a really outsized amount of good. And so a lot of the causes we work on today are trying to follow that same template. And some of them, such as criminal justice reform, focus on, you know, one sort of marginalized person. Farm animal welfare is this idea that, you know, it's possible that 100 years from now, we'll look back at the way that animals are treated on factory farms and say, actually, that was the worst thing going on at the time in terms of just how many creatures were being treated with incredible cruelty throughout their entire lives. And that may be something where we look back and say, actually, we should have considered those creatures to be persons, to be things that, you know, could experience pain and that we should care about, and that therefore that's one of the worst things we've done. And so anyone who's trying to help them was doing one of the best things they could be doing. So that's kind of the principle on which we believe that according to a certain set of assumptions, and I can get a little bit more into this later, how we treat very disparate worldviews and assumptions, but according to a certain set of assumptions, the importance of farm animal welfare is extremely high because you've got a lot of what we might want to consider persons worthy of moral consideration, just very, very large numbers of them being treated incredibly cruelly. And then in terms of the neglectedness and tractability, we basically believe that we're by far the largest funder in this field now. Many deals we go into, we would never be the largest funder, not even close at this amount. But the amount we're putting in, we are by far the largest funder on farm animal welfare, and we believe we've already seen really large impact. And so when we came in, there were these corporate campaigns where people would sort of try to embarrass various fast food companies or grocers into making what, in the end, is a pretty economically cheap pledge to go cage-free. Doesn't raise your cost much. We believe it makes a huge difference for the chickens. And basically what people were finding was they were getting a little bit of momentum, finding that, you know, I think they had gotten McDonald's to pledge to go cage-free by basically putting this pressure on them for something that ultimately McDonald's didn't care very much about. We came in and we really tried to supercharge this and move it ahead, and funded all the groups to greatly expand their operations. And since then, since we came in, we've seen basically essentially every major grocer and fast food company in America make a cage-free pledge. And so hopefully 10 years from now or so, you won't, any eggs you buy, they will all be cage-free, and that will be the only way to get them. And we don't think we're the only ones responsible for that win. We think there was already momentum, and all we did, we think, was speed things up and provide support, but we think that the return was extremely significant in terms of just animals' health per dollar. It's kind of an odd thing because I myself am not generally intuitively inclined to care about, let's say, chickens as much as humans. But on the other hand, you know, if you look at kind of the GiveWell top charities of, you know, let's say a human death averted for every few thousand dollars, and then you look at the farm animal welfare work, we're estimating something more like 100 chickens per dollar that are now not going to be in cages. So that's, you know, it's enough orders of magnitude there to make you think twice. And at least make you think, wow, it's possible under certain assumptions, and if we change our minds in certain ways in the future, or believe certain things in the future, that this really was outstanding work. And certainly in terms of just tangible impact, we believe we've seen it. Other things we've been doing in that cause is we've been trying to sort of repeat this overseas. So we came in a little bit on the tail end of the US cage-free stuff, and that there was already a little bit of momentum, although it was definitely exponential from when we came in. But we think that in a country like China, that's an area where meat consumption by default is likely to rise a great deal over time, and getting that foothold today could make a wave of corporate campaigns like this or something comparable possible in the future. And so we've been taking a much more long-term view overseas, but in Europe and Latin America and India and China, we've been trying to bolster the farm animal welfare movement, and in many cases, you know, kind of put something there where there was nothing. We are the only farm animal welfare funder, I think, essentially in China at all. And so that's kind of the other stuff we've been doing. And we've also been funding just research to better understand what kinds of things these corporate campaigns should be pushing for. So, you know, how could you reorganize some of these agricultural industries that the animals are suffering less, and then you can build those into these asks around these future corporate campaigns. So that's an example of some work we've done. Criminal justice reform is another one of our focus areas. I mentioned that a little bit ago. We picked that one because out of all the US policy issues we looked at, this one seemed to really stand out in terms of having practicality. We thought we could maybe see a path to impact. There's a bunch of reasons for that. One is that it's a state and local issue, and so it's a place where you can pick your battles on this issue, unlike many other important US policy issues. And it's also just an issue where I think the winds are changing a little bit. State budgets are tight, crime rates are down, and there is both liberal and conservative support in many cases for cutting incarceration. We do believe there's too much incarceration in the U.S. So that's another area where we've made a major focus. And we believe we've also seen some impact there. So we supported the Alliance for Safety and Justice, helped them expand faster in Illinois, and there was a bipartisan reform bill that we believe is going to lead to several thousand people a year less every year in prison, which we think is incredibly, you know, inhumane and a big impact. We've also supported the Close Records campaign in New York that, you know, a few months after it started, there was an announcement from the mayor that New York City does intend to close Rikers. The plan that's been outlined so far, I think, is not as aggressive as what we're hoping to see, but those are some examples there. Other causes we work on, we support scientific research funding, and so that is something that at past events, I've often kind of said we're still figuring out the framework for that. Now I think we have a pretty decent framework. We have a couple of senior science advisors. We have a list of areas of interest, and we generally ask them to be opportunistic and look across all of the things they're seeing to find especially tractable, especially exciting scientific opportunities. Some of the things we've done, we made a major grant for gene drives, research on gene drives, which we think could be one of the most likely paths to fully eliminating or eradicating malaria. And we also have been trying something. We also tried something this year where basically the National Institutes of Health has a special program for high-risk, high-reward scientific research, and it's very small. They fund almost none of the applications. So we essentially managed to get almost their entire reject pile, just all the things they didn't fund. And we went back through it and looked for things that we thought would be interesting to fund. And we did fund four projects. One of them, for example, is a shot at a cancer vaccine that I think is at a level of high-risk, high-reward that I think is even too much for pharma. Very hard to, you know, to put enough investment in one place to make a profit on that, but we thought it was worth a shot to fund. And then the final general category of what we work on, in addition to trying to focus on marginalized populations, we're also very interested in kind of civilizational or global catastrophic risks and potentially other X factors too, so things that could be upside possibilities as well as risks. But the basic idea is we believe that the world today is a little bit more interdependent and interconnected than it's ever been before. Probably easier for humans to drive ourselves extinct today than at like any point in the past, and it's only getting easier over time. And so one of the kind of angles that we take to try and do a lot of good per dollar is if you could make even a relatively small contribution to preventing a global catastrophe that could, you know, result in a new equilibrium, such as humanity going extinct, or such as some very bad and very durable and irreversible outcome, then you're not only helping the people who are directly affected today, you could be helping many, many, many future generations. And so that's another spin, or that's another take on how to get a lot for your money in some sense. Major causes there. We have not seen, you know, these are longer term, lower probability plays, but we do focus especially on biosecurity and pandemic preparedness and on potential risk for advanced AI. Those are basically the two things that are at the top of my list of if something was going to be catastrophic in a really global, far-reaching, irreversible way, probably come from one of those two areas. And a lot of what we've done is try to take what we consider the biggest, the worst cases, put them on the map, get them taken seriously, and build up fields of people who can provide expertise on them. So I'm happy to elaborate on all that in response to questions. Before I do that, I'm just going to talk a little bit more about just what we're trying to do organization-wide right now. So far we've chosen causes, we've hired people, we've made some grants, we've set up our basic processes around making grants, but some things that I think are really on the map for going forward and some of the things we're trying to do across the organization. One of them is just continue to heavily critique ourselves. So a lot of these causes that we're in rely on assumptions of one kind or another, or beliefs of one kind or another, and the deeper we get into a cause, the more we commit to it, the more money we put in. And in general, I believe that in this kind of philanthropy, you're much better off with like a 20-year massive financial commitment that is just very, very intense and allows the whole field to rely on you than you are sort of going piecemeal or making a new decision every year. And so the deeper we get into these causes, the more important it is to question our assumptions and beliefs. So for example, with criminal justice reform, we went into the cause with a view that the U.S. has just really outlier levels of incarceration, and that it's probably too much. That's conventional wisdom among the most informed people we talk to. But David Rudman, who you may have also heard about last session, did a really thorough investigation of the literature on, you know, let's say we did reduce incarceration, should we expect that to cause problems in terms of increased crime? And so he did really just one of the most, I guess probably just the most epic literature review I've ever seen on anything. He, you know, basically tried to find high quality studies, does incarceration affect crime, and in what direction, and at what margin, and he took all the studies that he could and found the data for them, reran them, reconstructed everything they found, often found weaknesses. I feel like just about half the studies he looks at in this way completely fall apart. And kind of try to synthesize the conclusions, and did come out feeling that there's not a ton of, at least in the current literature, not a ton of argument for the idea that, that incarceration at the current margins is doing really anyone much good. He thinks that, you know, basically his best guess is that the net effect on crime of increased of reduced incarceration at this time would be zero, because prison has some criminogenic effects as well as some crime preventing effects. So he thinks that at the present margin, those are probably coming somewhere close to netting out. And then we've done similar things in other causes. So we're doing kind of an extensive right now threat model for pandemics, trying to figure out what the biggest threats are and how big they are, and on the timelines, doing some work on just trying to think about the, you know, what can be known about advances in AI in the future and what kind of capabilities one might expect. And then we also did a report on, you know, is the K-3 reform really better for chickens? Someone, you know, challenged us on that, and we wanted to look into it and determine just how true it was. So those are some of the things we're doing. And then other things we're working on, I think we want to put more work and time into getting really good at self-assessment and looking backward, analyzing our impact, looking at it critically. So when we think we got a really good win, we kind of analyze it critically with historians, the same way that we've done our history of philanthropy case studies, and see if it's really what we thought it was, and we want to start booting up that process. And we also want to get better at comparing what our progress is and what impact we've seen to what we predicted at the time of making the grant. And one thing that's helped us with that is that for a very long time now, every time someone suggests a grant, they need to make predictions with probabilities and due dates on them. And so then we can go back when the grant is due for renewal and say, which of these predictions have come true or false by now? And that does help frame things. And then finally, a major project for us right now is cost prioritization. So that's figuring out how much money we ultimately want to put into these many very different goals with very different metrics. And that can be a little bit of a mind-bending challenge because, you know, sort of at first glance, you would just say, why don't we just fund all of the stuff that does the most good per dollar and stop funding when we run out of money. But your estimates of how much good you're doing per dollar can be very sensitive to things like whether you want to count helping chickens or not, or what fraction you want to count it as compared to humans, and also very sensitive to things like how many future generations are you helping if you do help prevent global catastrophic risk. And so sometimes when the calc is that sensitive and the question is that hard to answer, we think we need to do something other than just running the numbers. We think a lot of times we need to just say this is a really tough fork in the road and we're going to put some resources in each branch. And figuring out how to do that in a principled way, I think, is something that we're struggling with right now. So that is who we are, what we've done so far, and I'll just spend the rest of the time taking questions. Yep.
Do you approach like allocation the way that like a financial manager would, where like you have like you said about the 50-40-10 at the beginning? Like, do you like redistribute based on like, okay, like this seems like it's losing a lot of money investments, and like this fund seems like it's making way more than we expected, and like, it was only supposed to be 10%, so we can reallocate away? Like, how do you?
Sure. So do we handle allocation like a financial manager would? Do we look at performance and reallocate money based on that? But most of the answer to this is we don't know yet. So most of the answer to this is like 2 years ago, we were just starting to give it scale, and we kind of just had starter budgets that we thought would be big enough to see how things go, see what kind of impact we're having. And we're only now even starting to be capable of asking, you know, how are different portfolios performing relative to each other? And still not really. I mean, I think 2 years is just, for, in my opinion, for Headspace philanthropy, 2 years is just not long enough to know if you're having an impact yet 90% of the time. There are a couple causes where we think we've had some impact. There's one cause, farm animal welfare, where we think we've had a lot of impact, but I don't think it's really time yet to start judging these portfolios in a definitive way. But so I think we're figuring out that framework. But you know, I do think ultimately that we want a cause allocation that pays attention to how much good we think we can accomplish in each cause. And you know, in theory, what we want to do is do the most good total, which means that we'd like to take money out of causes where we're doing less good per dollar, put it into more causes where we can do more good per dollar. And of course, there are some of those issues that I brought up before, where some of the numbers can be very sensitive to deep questions. So I think we're still feeling our way along with that. One thing I will say is that an important difference that I think it's easy to miss in philanthropy versus for-profit investing is the idea that I think risk aversion makes a lot less sense in philanthropy than in for-profit investing, and that can actually change a lot of things. So you know, if you're doing for-profit investing, someone will tell you to diversify, which means instead of just betting all your money on one stock, you should bet it on a bunch of stocks to lower your worst-case scenario. But actually, if you weren't worried about going broke, if you're doing this sort of, you know, for the world instead of yourself, and you care about the total amount of wealth in the world, and you weren't worried about going broke, you might actually be better off just putting all your money into the one stock that you think is the best bet. It would be scary from a personal point of view, but from a total amount of wealth in the world view, it might be better. And so I think in philanthropy it's odd, and I think it's easy to miss, but there's fewer reasons to diversify, and I think there's more of a default position of, if the best thing can take all the money, then that's what we should do, period. And then I think there are actually some considerations in favor of diversification, but not as many, and it's not as obvious. And that's one of the things that we're really, you know, really kind of debating internally right now as we try and set the budgets. Yep.
So is all of your money come from,
does all our money come from one donor? So Carry Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz are the, you know, the funding partner that we're focused on right now. Dustin is the co-founder of Facebook. And you know, at this time, the level of giving we're at is lower than the level of giving they eventually want to be at. And so for that reason, we're just not very focused on going out and raising money, finding other funding partners. There have been, you know, I think it would not be quite right to say they're the only funder. So there's definitely cases where raise money in one way or another from another donor. A lot of times it's more a matter of saying, hey, here's a cause area, or here's an organization that we recommend, and then someone will give to it. And we actually have a blog post coming out about that, I would say this month, that's going to talk in a little bit more detail about just what we've seen from external partnerships. And so I would actually say that there have been cases where, in one way or another, we're talking to another donor, we're making recommendations, they're following the recommendations, and that is money move. But in terms of, you know, in terms of just process-wise, the process is mostly just built around Carrie and Dustin for now, because we have the longest running relationship with them. Carrie's in the office. We are able to kind of have a process with them in the loop, and then we, you know, are not really in need of additional funds at the organizational level right now, because of the fact that they're not as high as their giving eventually needs to be. That said, there are some causes where we've like given someone a budget, and then that person has been much more aggressive in raising money from external donors to supplement the funds they're getting from Carrie and Dustin.
Cool. So if you're, I guess your time horizon is to spend it before they die, or?
Yeah, I mean, that's
what does that look like in terms of the breakup of like spending money now versus like, a few decades from now?
Sure, so what's the time horizon for spending money? Yeah, Carrie doesn't want to give away, you know, the vast majority of their wealth within their lifetimes. That does imply certain things about how high giving will have to be at its peak level in order for that to happen. And definitely the current number is lower than it will be at peak. I don't think we're committed to any particular schedule, so a lot of what's going on right now is I'm thinking we are still learning, and I think this would be the wrong time to go up to peak giving. I think it's very hard. It's like much easier to grow a budget than to shrink a budget in philanthropy, because you've got kind of fields and organizations relying on you. So I think we want to put in more thought and have more of a sense that we've kind of nailed every aspect of our work before we kind of aim for the peak. That said, I think once we feel we really know what we're doing, I mean, there won't be any rule against spending it all in 1 year if we think that's the best thing to do. My guess is that in many cases, we want to reserve some capital, A, to be able to make long-term commitments, stay in the field for a long time, be reliable. I think a lot of what philanthropists are able to do is help the field grow. To help the field grow, people need to believe there's a career in the field, they can work in it, they can be constant support. So I think a lot, there's a lot of good reasons to make sure you have enough to stay around for a while, not forever. And then I also think there's just generic, you know, it's good to keep some dry powder in case something outstanding comes up. So I don't know exactly how it's gonna work, but my guess is we're going to spend a little longer making sure we really know what we're doing, and then we'll have more of an idea, and then probably probably we'll bring the level of giving up significantly, and then slowly down. Yeah.
I've been impressed with the apparent success of open health funding on farm animal welfare, but there are orders of magnitude more wild animals than farm animals, and some of them may be conscious. Does
sure. So farm animal welfare versus sort of wild animal welfare. You know, there's more animals in the wild than on farms. Have we thought about trying to improve the welfare of wild animals? And certainly, you know, it does seem like there are certain cases in which, you know, whether for human behavior reasons or otherwise, there's definitely there can be cases where you would look at wild animal situations and say yes, welfare could be improved a lot. So are we interested in that? I mean, like you said, I think we do not perceive a lot of funding opportunity right there right now. Like I think there is actually a huge difference between wild animal and farm animal welfare in terms of just like what can you do. Farm animal welfare is a case where incredibly abusive things are happening. I mean, I think it's really, you know, to anyone who hasn't kind of read a book about this or watched a video about this, it's not, the objection here is goes way beyond the idea of killing animals for meat. It's how they're treated throughout their lives. It's incredibly inhumane way that just it really just looks like it's someone trying to squeeze every penny of cost out of it and not give any regard at all for the comfort of the animal. And you make people aware of that. You know, you just the cage-free stuff, a lot of it is just you kind of highlight to a fast food company's customers that the chickens are in tiny cages. People just don't feel good about that. And then there's, you know, there's some embarrassment and there's a change in policy and a lot of animals are affected at once. So there's this kind of this opportunity sitting there that this behavior is going on that really people, I think, should not be proud of, and most people would not feel comfortable about it if they saw it and knew about it. And it's a human-run system. And so you can get, you know, changes made at scale. I don't see anything like that for wild animal welfare, and I, you know, I haven't really seen anything to fund that looks comparably effective. You know, if some giving opportunities came up, I think we would just look at them and think about, you know, what is this? Is this a good, you know, would this help a lot of animals for a little money? Does this have other issues? I think sometimes with wild animal welfare, you would worry about interfering with natural habitat. We'd have to weigh that against, you know, whatever the opportunity was. So there are certain categories of things where maybe, you know, cutting back on human abuses that lower harms to wild animals. There may be other things that are intrusive, and you have to weigh that against the benefit you're seeing. So at this point, I mostly don't have much comment on it. It's the kind of thing where we're aware of it at a low level, and if there were more kind of shovel-ready things to do, places to write checks, I think we'd have to have a conversation at that point. I have a follow-up?
Oh, yeah, so I feel like there's not much to do in terms of like practical change right now, but like the open health funds a lot of research, and it seems like the global appeal of wild kind of welfare might be something that
sure. So one of the things you could fund is research and on wild animal welfare and just like people thinking about, is there maybe stuff we could do? And that is something where, again, I mean, actually, even at that meta level, I'm not aware of what I consider very, you know, opportunities that I've looked at and said, boy, that looks like a good return and, you know, addresses all the issues one might have. But again, I mean, if it came up, we would discuss it at that point.
Yep. Great, thanks so much. My question is also in the animal welfare area. A recent grant with The Guardian to fund journalism. And so it's about animal welfare, but it's also about the role of journalism. folks see as their role of journalism, and have you funded other journalistic projects outside of the animal welfare area? And just how do you think about that? And also, how do you think about measuring impact around journalism?
Sure. So what do we think of as the role of journalism? How do we measure impact? And this is in reference to a recent grant we announced to The Guardian to fund. So I'll try and explain the grant. I mean, basically, the Guardian is a mainstream media publication. They've got a significant interest in farm animal welfare. But, you know, journalism, I think, is an increasingly difficult enterprise financially. And these are not the articles that are the easiest to support in the typical financial ways, through perhaps corporate sponsors, through advertising. And so what we've tried to do is provide support that enables them to cover, you know, farm animal welfare a lot more than they would be able to otherwise, to hire investigative journalists, and to go do some of the work that we think is, you know, one great example of how journalism can shine a light on horrible practices, but doesn't seem as financially viable right now as a lot of other things journalism can do that we think are less impactful. We are trying to support that. It is an experiment, and so we have not done anything else like that. The Guardian is the only thing going on right now, and we do see it as just kind of, let's see how this goes. Certainly the Guardian is planning to share with us whatever data they have on, you know, well, first up, we're going to look at how the articles come out, and are the articles good, and are they shining a light on important information, and then we're going to look at, are these articles getting attention, and there are some measures of that, you know, shares and likes and all that stuff, and Guardian's going to share that info with us. So that will be, you know, that will be some of how we evaluate it. I mean, we don't have any one formula for evaluating a grant, and a lot of things we do are just kind of, it'll be hard to observe the impact within the next 5 to 10 years or maybe ever, but we can at least get an intermediate sense of, is quality journalism happening? Is there buzz about it from communities of people who seem to be, you know, placed to do something about it? And then there's the more generic measures of traffic. So we're going to see how it goes. And I can imagine doing similar things on other causes, but we aren't at the moment looking at anything like that. Guardian was just like a good combination of an issue that we thought journalism could do a lot for, and also they were like really excited to do it, and they wanted to hire those people. And, you know, it wasn't something where we were kind of trying to push it on them, it was more we were trying to make it possible to cover that the way they wanted to. Yep.
So in addition to like the different areas that you described, OpenFell also gives grants to GiveWell's charities, right?
Yep.
So I'm wondering, how does the amount of money that OpenFell has compare to the amount of money needed to, say, eradicate malaria or things like that, solve some of the problems that GiveWell's top charities do? And is OpenFill intentionally holding back from that? Is that because there might be better opportunities? Is it because there's not enough room for more funding right now? Or?
Yeah. So what is you know, OpenFill does recommend to Carrie Dustin that they make grants to GiveWell top charities. And that, you know, that's been an evolving thing over time, because originally when we met Carrie Dustin, we just were GiveWell, and that was the first thing we were doing that they were excited about that they wanted to give to. And so it's not, you know, it's not as though I sort of like came to Carrie Dustin saying, hey, there's this thing called GiveWell, you know, that's not a history. But the part OpenFill plays in this is we do try to help Carrie Dustin figure out how much each year to give to GiveWell's top charities relative to all the other things they're contemplating. And this is something where our thinking has had a lot of ups and downs and evolved a lot. And so, you know, one thing to just keep in mind, I mean, the room for funding on the GiveWell side has been going up over time. So now it's in the several $100 million a year range. And we're, you know, OpenFill giving, not including GiveWell top charities, OpenFill giving is like $100 to $200 million a year. So, you know, to fill that gap, would at least for starters, it would be like a doubling or more, and probably that number is gonna go up more over time. So that's a thing to know. And I think one of the principles we followed here is just kind of throughout, we followed a principle of some degree of caution and not wanting to take irreversible actions. And so there was a time in previous years where we had a very tentative guess that we actually thought GiveWell top charities were probably better than alternative uses of that money, in the sense that, you know, whenever we're contemplating a grant, we kind of compare it to the last dollar, because you can make this grant or you can save the money. And if you save the money, then you'll sort of spend it at the end after everything else that you funded. And we used to have a view that the GiveWell top charities were probably better than the alternate use of that money, and yet we still didn't recommend fully funding them because we were very unsure about that. And what we didn't want to do was start to create a precedent where, you know, every time Open Phil or Carrie Dustin likes something, they fully fund it, and everyone else should stop funding it. So I think, you know, I think Givewell's in a good place in terms of raising a growing amount of money from individual donors, and I think if we, you know, if we had recommended to fill that whole gap, I think the individual donors, quite rightly, would have stopped giving there, and I think it would have been hard to resurrect that. It would have been hard to resurrect that whole situation. So that was the situation at a point in time. At this point in time, the situation is different. So at this point in time, we basically feel that according to some worldviews and sets of assumptions about the world, the last dollar is actually going to do more good than Givewell's top charities. And examples of those worldviews, I think if you're a person who is who believes, for example, that you should care about chickens 10% as much as humans, for example, then you probably think we could spend that last dollar on something better than Givewell's top charities, on animal-focused things. Similarly, if you're a person who has a particular aggressive set of views about future generations and the importance of future generations and the number and the nature of future generations, then you might think that the last dollar spent on global catastrophic risk prevention in the end is going to be helping more people per dollar in expectation than Givewell's top charities. And if you reject both of those, there might still be other views you would have, but there is some set of views that we think is reasonable that says actually Givewell's top charities are better than the last dollar. And so what do you do with that? And then it becomes a matter of just saying it's sort of the worldview allocation problem, which is how much money do you want to put down this fork in the road, this path in the fork versus that path in the fork. And so the kind of concept is we want to divide up the money, and some of the money is going to follow one worldview, one set of assumptions, some of the money is going to follow another worldview, and according to our best understanding and our best, you know, estimates of how that allocation is going to end up when we're done with it, that is how we determine the Givewell allocation this year. So actually, this year the number does not, it's not based on the funding gap. It never has been based on individual donors. We've never done the thing where we say, you know, let's give less if individual donors are giving more. Never done matching either. So it's in the past been a function of the funding gap, and this year it's not. This year it's just a function of how much money do we eventually expect to spend under that set of assumptions that favors Givewell top charities. And then based on that, we work with Givewell to determine, you know, how much should come out this year, based on how much is going to come out eventually. And we also did some rounding, so the number ended up being $75 million, which is not nearly enough to close the gap, not even half. So that's the situation.
You mentioned some follow-up research into whether going cage-free was effective. How has that been going?
Sure, so we follow-up research on whether cage-free is actually good for chickens. We put a blog post up about this, and it goes to a write-up, so there's a lot of detail about this on the web. You know, we concluded mostly that our original view was essentially right. We're less confident in it than we were at the beginning, so I think we did learn some things that made us pause a bit. I think there's a little bit of ambiguity. There's this sort of there's a possibility that mortality goes up in the cage-free systems, and there's a view that that's mostly because the cage-free systems, it's like when you transition to them, you have to learn a whole new set of practices. And so it could be that things get worse for a period of time and then get a bit better. And it could be that mortality is even higher in the long run because the chickens are kind of more free to interact with each other. We think that's probably offset by the chickens getting through a lot more of the sort of natural animal behaviors. And so, you know, overall we ended up feeling like the state of the literature is not what we wish it was. The thing is not totally unambiguous, but we do think that the cage-free reforms are, you know, in the end, roughly as good for chickens as we thought they were. I do want to clarify, we don't think cage-free systems as used on industrial farms, we don't think those are humane, we don't think those are okay, we don't think those are reasonable, but we have been pushing for things to get better one step at a time, and that is not going to be the last ask as far as layer ends, but also for now, you know, we're also moving on some of the corporate campaigns to other asks, such as broiler chickens and other treats. Yep.
When you think broadly about cause allocation, how do you make trade-offs between kind of length of suffering, severity of suffering, and mortality?
Sure. So when we think about cause allocation, how do we make trade-offs between length of suffering, severity of suffering, and mortality? I think Givewell has probably done more work than Open Phil on those particular trade-offs, and so we're able to, you know, when needed, we're able to borrow a lot of their work, where, you know, a lot of it is just laying out the tough questions you have to answer, having different people who have been paying a lot of attention, so people on staff put in their numbers, their assumptions, taking some aggregate statistics like medians. So we're, you know, and those people who are filling the numbers are also trying to work off research showing how the general population might value those numbers. So we're able to borrow that when needed. It hasn't been as big, that particular set of questions has not been as big an issue for Open Fill. We've more, you know, more of the kind of deep judgments have to do with the number of future generations and the relative importance of animals. Just don't think those trade-offs have been really crucial in the decisions we've made so far. Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, so the last couple clauses that you mentioned, AI risk, global catastrophic risk, something about them just doesn't sit right with me, and I'm just going to think out loud for a second because I don't know exactly what it is, but they're different than a lot of the other clauses you work on in that they're not neglected, or they're not as neglected in that the incentives are aligned. It's not like the people who are doing the damage wouldn't suffer in the same way, whereas in a lot of other causes, the suffering is due to people being like disconnected and not, the incentives aren't aligned basically. Whereas in this cause, like everybody would kind of suffer equally and everybody's like in the same boat. And just something about them just doesn't sound like philanthropy to me. And I don't know exactly what that is, but I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Sure. So the global catastrophic risk causes, you know, something doesn't sit right. They don't feel philanthropic. And I do think a lot, I have some similar intuition to what you're saying. I'm not saying it's the same. But I think some of it may come from that observation that global catastrophic risks are not about helping people who can't help themselves. It's a lot about working on issues that affect everyone. And that raises the question, well, why are these neglected or are these neglected? And so, you know, if you have something that might wipe out civilization, it seems like something everyone should care about. And so why is it neglected? Is it neglected? Why are we working on it? And can that really be called philanthropy if it's something that sort of benefits everyone equally and isn't about trying to benefit especially marginalized folks? And so I do hear like all those properties being true. That said, I think global catastrophic risks are extraordinarily neglected. I think there's really solid arguments that they're more neglected than even some of the other work we do. So I think, weirdly, I feel quite confident that the potential risks for advanced AI we're worried about are far more neglected than criminal justice reform, even though I think criminal justice reform is pretty neglected in the scheme of things. So why is that? I mean, one thing is to think about climate change as just sort of an example or a point along this spectrum, and we've done some climate change work as well. You know, in theory, climate change affects everyone and everyone should care about it. In practice, a lot of the work on climate change mitigation is coming from nonprofits, is coming from altruistic folks. And, you know, I think you could try to explain why that is. I mean, I think some of it is just that it affects everyone, but in a very diffuse way. And so, you know, if I were running the U.S. Department of Defense, probably I'm more worried about, like, various things that might embarrass the U.S. or just, you know, hurt it in a more proximate, higher probability way. And in some sense, like, all of civilization going under is not, like, a lot worse from the perspective of the military doing its job than, let's say, you know, a problematic military loss or something like that. And so I think that even though everyone has some incentive to care about global catastrophic risk, it's like the amount that any one person or any one institution or even any one government is really threatened by these things that could be a very long way off and a very low probability is actually quite minimal. And a lot of times, higher likelihood but less large problems can occupy their attention. So I think that is certainly the case for climate change. I think it's even more the case for kind of worst-case pandemics, and even more the case for potential risk for advanced AI. And yeah, I mean, I think I feel a little bit odd if like all of the philanthropy is going into this kind of thing, sort of for reasons you say. But you know, ultimately, I look at the situation and I think, for whatever reason, I mean, I can speculate why, but for whatever reason, really, these are very neglected. Really, they are not getting much attention, and really, we believe we can make a huge difference in the size and feel of people who pay attention to these things. And if our goal is to help the most people for the least money, that actually does seem quite competitive with everything else we're doing. Yep.
Do you have any investment in for-profit corporations? And if so, which one and how much? If not, would you
would it be something that you would consider?
Sure. So the question is about for-profit investing. Do we do that? Would we do that? So in general, as a general matter, we think of our expertise, our specialization, as finding ways to help people as opposed to make a profit for ourselves. And so any time the main case for something is make a profit, we think that there will be other people better positioned to evaluate that than we are.
There could be for-profit corporations that would make the world a better place for everybody and are neglected for some reasons that the market doesn't solve.
Sure. So there could be neglected for-profit corporations. I mean, I think as a general matter, I think that there's a lot more people interested in for-profit investing than in nonprofit. And so I think if we're trying to sort of fund the things no one else will fund or do better than other people, I think we have a much tougher field to contend with in for-profit than nonprofit. So generally, we focus on the part of an investment that is not paying for itself. That said, there's no reason we can't do for-profit investments, and we have, but it's just when we do them, we would tend to say, we think that this thing is more good for the world than it is profitable, which means we're willing to sacrifice some financial return on it, which means that we kind of, we think of it as sort of a generic investment plus a grant. That's one way to think of it. So if you sort of invest in a company that you think has, let's say, a 10% chance of getting you a 5x return, you might think of that as 50% just sort of normal investment or something, and then 50% grant, and that's how we would tend to think of it. So, we don't really try to have an edge on assessing the financial side, but when we think the benefits of society are greater than the profits, we may make an investment and call the grant that size. And so an example of this, we do have, an investment in Impossible Foods, and they're a company that's trying to make plant-based, burgers and other things that are really convincing and that, really taste like burgers and that could possibly replace burgers. And, here's a case where I think the amount of good to be done is in some sense greater than the amount of profit to be made. Because certainly if you could pull that off, you would make money, you would sell hamburgers, but you wouldn't be getting paid for all the animal suffering you were averting, as well as some of the climate change implications of this and other implications. So, we have done it. But in general, it's the kind of thing where we have our causes, we look for the best things to do. If the best thing to do happens to be an investment instead of a grant, we'll make the investment. But we don't look specifically for investments. Yeah?
I'm interested in the commentary you were making about individual giving and the trade-off of a sort of sure thing that will give me at least some sense, in the Givewell sense, that I've done some good. Versus the high risk, possibly high yield giving that you're able to do. What kind of advice do you give to individual, let's say, regular folk who are trying to think about how to do some good with their giving relative to those two models?
Sure. So what advice do we give to individual donors? And can I talk more about the relationship between individual donors and sort of the mega donors like Carrie and Dustin? I do think it's easy to oversimplify this stuff, so I do want to make clear. I think Givewell does do some work that's quite high risk, long term, high reward, and they do serve some like very large donors, and including Carrie Dustin, and I think that makes sense. But I do think of the two organizations as sort of occupying different places on the spectrum, where in general what Givewell recommends is going to be something where the full case is going to be written up online, you can check every component of it, and you can have a certain sense that this is all holding together and making sense. And I think in general, that is going to be an especially attractive thing for people who are trying to make a giving decision relatively quickly. Whereas I think OpenPhil tends to occupy the niche more with some of the wackiest, the most ambitious, the highest risk things, and a lot of times these things are most appropriate for people who really, really trust the people they're dealing with, often in a way where they may want to build that trust up over the course of years. So it's not a totally thick line. And to illustrate that, the advice I would give to individual donors is I would kind of, and did we end up running, do we have this post on this, the three kinds of individual donors, or is that not up?
No, but there's okay. Is Arguable's top charities the best option for every donor blog post, which
okay.
I would highly
Great.
Recommend since I think it exactly addresses this question.
Great, so that blog post, I think that the possibilities I would outline, I would say giving to Givewell top charities is like one great option. I think if you're very insistent on doing things that are kind of like in the more high-risk bucket, then I think you have to ask yourself, like, is there someone you trust to do some things that are, you know, going to be harder to explain and, like, less checkable than GiveWell? And then you can, you know, you can fund that person or that organization if so. And if you are looking to kind of fund the sorts of things OpenPhil does, there are these funds called the Effective Altruist Funds that were set up by another organization, but a lot of them are kind of administered by OpenPhil staff. And so, for example, there's an animal welfare fund, and that is a fund that, like, Lewis, who runs our farm animal welfare work, he will draw from that fund to fund things that, you know, to supplement his OpenPhil budget. And so that option does exist, but, you know, you're not going to get the same. There's also, like, a, you know, a far future fund that has the future generations idea, also with an OpenPhil staffer. But, you know, you can give to those if you want. You're not going to get the same level of transparency and, you know, sort of the whole case be online that you get from GiveWell, and I think the level of trust you need is higher. Yeah, I'm going to take a couple more.
Just what organization does the Effective Altruism Fund that you're
talking about? The Center for Effective Altruism. I think like two more. Yeah.
Sorry, you spoke about the differences between the worldview of someone who would be more inclined towards GiveWell's funds, the causes that they support, and the worldview of somebody who would be more inclined towards open philanthropy, OpenPhil.
Yeah.
I noticed that there's one particular person who's involved in founding both of those organizations. How much of those two different worldviews reflect the evolution of your own worldview, or, you know, it seems interesting that they seem to be going two different directions and that you're involved.
Sure. So my own view on the two going different directions. I mean, you know, quick point of clarification, but there's a lot of people who've been, like, heavily involved in both GiveWell and Open Philanthropy. But I mean, in terms of answering your question, I actually like both. I think I generally in this space feel that extremes are good, and the middle is my least favorite place to be. So in my view. You know, if you want to do something where you're being very self-skeptical and you're making sure everything checks out, I think GiveWell does a better job of that than anyone else. And if you want to take risks, I think you should risk big. Like, I'm actually fairly uncomfortable with some of the higher risk philanthropy, you know, sort of by default or generally. And I feel that, you know, when you start doing this kind of giving with a 10 or 20 year time horizon, you're doing something inherently very difficult, and it's easy to be overconfident, it's easy to fail. And so I want to make up for that by, if you can win, I want the win to be really, really, really huge. And so the kind of stuff we do, OpenPhil, I like it. And I'm excited by it because I think the wins are big enough to justify that. I frankly think that a lot of philanthropy falls right in the middle, where people are doing things that, you know, they're on a 10 or 20 year quest to change some giant social problem, but their best case is actually only okay. And would, you know, even their best case makes it kind of hard to come out looking better than GiveWell Top Charities. So for me, I like both extremes quite a bit. I personally give to GiveWell Top Charities, so I, you know, I believe in an allocation to both. I think some of the, you know, if I look at the, maybe not surprisingly, OpenPhil pursues a little bit more high variance, so I think the very best of OpenPhil's doing, I like better than GiveWell Top Charities, but I wouldn't say that about all of it, and I, you know, continue to kind of have unstable views about this, and certainly, you know, I personally have recommended both and give to both, and, you know, certainly haven't just, like, dropped one from my portfolio. Take, like, one more. Yeah.
Can you give an overview in terms of percentages or dollar amounts by college area that you mentioned, the Justice Forum and the Welfare, I guess, AI, pandemic? How did it break down in terms of funding, and I guess, how did you decide to allocate?
Sure. So how does the budget break down by cause area, and how did we decide that? I mean, so far we've not been very principled about it, but so far the thing we've said is we want to start giving, we want to start experimenting, and when we're in a cause, so there's kind of two different paradigms of doing, working on a cause. One of them would be like, we have kind of a very casual interest in the cause, and someone who's kind of a generalist on staff will work on it, and in that case it just tends to be by the grant. And so if someone finds a grant, we make it. If we think that grant is better than the last dollar or is a good learning opportunity. And then, you know, when we hire specialists, it's more important to set a budget. Because, you know, we might be hiring someone really passionate about farm animal welfare. So if we make it all by the grant, that's going to give them too much incentive to kind of, you know, play up the goodness of their grants relative to everything else. So then we need to set a target. Again, I want those targets to be more principled in the future than they are now. For now, a lot of what we've done is we've just said, first off, Like, we want to make a big enough commitment to this cause that we can be a major player, get top talent, be reliable to the field, and, you know, for major commitment, we kind of look to what other foundations' major program areas look like, and it tends to be in the tens of millions of dollars per year. And then we've made, like, adjustments from the starting point where we kind of have an annual portfolio review process where the program officer would say, well, if I had a little bit more money, this is the kind of thing I'd be more of. If I had a lot more money, this is the kind of thing I'd be more of. We kind of look at it and just look for some sort of inflection point of diminishing returns and go with what feels good. But it has not been very principled so far. So we put a lot of work into choosing the right causes, choosing the right people, having the right process. But getting the right dollar amounts, that's a future thing for us, and it's in progress. Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, so just are all of them, I guess, funded roughly the same amount, or?
No, it did vary by cause. So it's with the specialist causes, it's going to be like tens of millions per year. And with other causes, it's going to be by the grant, so it can just like vary a lot, and it kind of depends on just what the year was. Cool. Okay, so that's all the questions I take for now. I'll stick around for 10 to 20 minutes if you folks just want to come up and ask more questions. And thanks, everyone, for coming.